Piero. Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Align the lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I am your host, Nick Taro Jr. For today's episode, I will be discussing the life and the photographic artwork of a mysterious and enigmatic photographer. His name is Miroslav Tichý, and Tichý was active from the 1960s into the 1990s in what was known as Czechoslovakia, which at the time was under communist rule. Tichý lived on the margins of society for the most part, and he was seen by most of the people in the small town that he lived in as mostly a poor vagrant. He definitely suffered from mental health issues throughout his life, but beyond that, he was at the core an artist. Tichý used photography as his main mode of expression, and he mostly focused on the women of the small village that he lived in, oftentimes photographing them in public spaces with a very voyeuristic approach. Beyond that, Tichý handcrafted the cameras and lenses that he used to create his photography. In many ways, the people of the village dismissed Tichý or saw him possibly as a nuisance. The authorities, of course, saw him as a threat, and he considered himself a dissident in the lifestyle choices that he made. And so I discovered Tichý's work a few years ago, and I was always fascinated by it. Came across a recent publication of some new work that was released, and I reached out to the Tichý Ocean Foundation, which handles all of the estate and all of the artwork produced by Miroslav Tichý. My guest is the director of the Tichý Ocean Foundation, Roman Buxbaum. And we have a really deep conversation about the perceptions and the realities of Tichý and his artwork. And I was thrilled that Roman agreed to be a guest on my podcast. But I was also excited to find out that Roman Buxbaum actually knew Tichý when he was alive. And so this is all firsthand knowledge of a mysterious figure in the world of photography. And I was just really excited to have this conversation. So without further ado, here's my chat with Roman Buxbaum. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast, Roman Buxbaum.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Nick.
Great. Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you as well. I want to just give you a little bit of background before we start talking. So I've been aware of Miroslav Tichý's photography for quite a few years. And actually, one of the books I have, I believe you authored this book. Is that correct?
Yes, actually, this is the first book of Miroslav Tichý, which we have done 2006 for the first exposition in Brno in Czech Republic.
Okay, great. And well, it's good then that I'm right at the start. Then I reached out to you via it's the Tichý Foundation. Are you part of this? And can you give me the formal title of the organization?
Yes, we call it Tichý Ocean Foundation.
Okay.
Because, as you know, Tichý is the name of the artist, but it also, in Czech language, means silent. And Tichý Ocean is the Pacific Ocean.
Oh.
And it happened in a in a long night with Miroslav that he started fantasizing about the Pacific Ocean and all the unique treasures that they are. And after one or two big glasses of wine, I told him, Miroslav, we will call our foundation Tichy Ocean Foundation, Pacific Ocean.
I love it. I love it. So that's something from a language difference. I wouldn't have even understood that. So that's very cool. Thank you. So why don't you, to just introduce yourself to my audience, just tell me or tell us who you are and how you got connected with Tichy's work.
Yes, gladly, Nick. I am born in Prague in Czech Republic and grew up partially also in a little town in Moravia, which is called Kyiv. And our house was at the same street as family Tichy's house. Wow. So usually I say this project is already in third generation because my grandmother was the best friend of Tichy's mother. And then my uncle, Pari, also a psychiatrist like myself, was the best friend of Miroslav Tichy.
Wow.
So actually, I knew Tichy from birth. And I remember being maybe 2 or 3 years playing underneath the table and looking at his shoes when he was sitting in the kitchen and my grandmother was cooking dinner for us. So I grew up with him, actually.
Wow. Amazing.
So I'm born in Prague in Czech Republic, and 1968 our family fled after the Soviet invasion of Prague to Switzerland. And since then I live in Zurich. I have studied medicine and became a psychiatrist. After that, I also studied arts in Munich at the academy and was a performing artist in my 30s, 40s. Ended up in theater performances. And then, of course, I dedicated a large part of my energy and time to this unbelievable oeuvre of Miroslav Tichy that I discovered already in the 80s and documented for 15 years before Harald Zeman would ask me to do an exhibition.
Were you, let me ask you about, so you said that you knew Tichy personally. He was a bit older. He was your father in your father's age, or your uncle was good friends with him. And you said you have memories of him when you were a child. Were you aware then of clearly hindsight is 2020, and we now we're having this conversation because of the work that he was creating. Were you aware of who he was and what kind of artist he was and what kind of life he was leading at a young age? Did you know any of this?
Well, since we left when I was 12 years old, of course, there was only a personal relationship at my childhood age. But later, when I was an artist myself and I studied in Munich, I often visited my grandmother and Miroslav Tichý. And then it was in the mid-80s, I discovered this immense oeuvre of photography, which he wouldn't show anybody else. But because we were close since three generations, I would say,
right,
he opened up the door and I saw this immense mountains of photographic works. And that's how it started.
So you were the first, you in essence, you discovered this body of, no one would have seen it maybe if you had not stumbled upon it.
Well, it would have been for sure destroyed and nobody would have ever known it.
Wow. That's amazing. We all have you to thank for this, just even knowing, most of us knowing him and knowing his work then.
Yes. So the first task was to document. So I started in the early 80s to do audios, then first videos. I bought one of the first black and white video cameras. And later, when I saw that there is a publicity coming, I started to document him professionally. And there is a nice movie that I can share with you through Vimeo if you would like it. It by the name Tarzan Retired.
Tarzan Retired.
Yes, which we did for the Czech television.
Wow. I would, yes, absolutely would love to see that. So this work, there's this sort of mythology, I think, around Tichý, and the things that I've read or seen, little clips of videos, maybe it's from the video that you're recommending. Can we talk a little bit about his life in the, it was a small town that he lived in, correct? Yeah. So tell me about the town that, tell me about the town and tell me a little bit about Tichý's sort of presence in the town.
Kyiv is a small town in southern Moravia, about 20,000 people by now. And Miroslav was the son of a cloth maker.
A tailor,
yes. Yeah. His father was quite a successful tailor.
Okay.
And Miroslav was an intelligent but fragile boy in his young days. And already early on, he unfortunately showed signs of a psychotic disease, on and off, disturbing his way of life, his artistic way of life. Mm-hmm. He studied from 1945 till 1948 at the Academy of Fine Arts in Prague. And in 1948 was a difficult time because there was a communist putsch in Czechoslovakia, which meant that the teachers at the academy were exchanged. And Miroslav tells very nice stories how in the drawing class, which he loved, where he would draw mute figures, which should stay for his whole life, the motifs that he followed. So suddenly, instead of female models, the student would find workers in working uniforms, stretching out the hand.
Right.
And they were supposed to draw now these socialist drawings and paintings. So in this atmosphere, he stopped going to the academy and started to just wander around in Prague. The unpleasant consequence was that he was then excluded and had to go to military for 2 years, which was in the 50s in the Eastern Bloc, quite a dangerous situation. In the military, he had a mental breakdown and was hospitalized for the first time. Fortunately, by this time, my uncle, his best friend, was already a psychiatrist in a clinic nearby. So he took his friend Miroslav to his clinic. And from there, he would return home to his mother and father and stay there for the rest of his life.
Was the treatment that your uncle was providing, was it effective? Was it helpful? Did it help, from what I understand, his mental problems, his mental illness was throughout his life, as you said, from early on. But the fact that he was getting care, and he was getting care from your uncle, did that provide some stability or protection for Miroslav?
Well, it did provide, of course, protection. And thanks to my uncle, he would be released home and could start his artistic career, which he continued, as you know, in secret. But Miroslav, unfortunately, had a very severe psychotic disease, a schizophrenic disorder. And through his life, he has had all the terrible treatments that there were before an antipsychotic medication was invented.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine, just knowing that time frame and what kind of treatment for that illness was available, I'm sure it was not pleasant process.
In the end, he stayed a very pleasant and socially competent person, but always he suffered from psychotic fears and delusions. Mm-hmm. But opposite to other artists who suffer from mental illnesses, he would not work during his psychotic episodes. Mm-hmm. He would stop. So, for example, in the hospital, they would ask him if he wants to do some drawings or paintings, and he would deny that. He would say, "I'm not crazy." So, I would not consider him an art brute, artist.
Right.
But an artist with a psychosis that would from time to time bother him. But in his healthy part, he would be functional, even though he had severe disturbances.
Right. So, yeah, so it sounds like there were periods when he was stable enough to focus and be productive in his work. That's interesting, actually, because I think that's also, if we consider other famous artists who suffered from mental illness, that, you know, I think of like Van Gogh, or, you know, like struggling to work through it or being tormented, you know, maybe this is this Hollywood version of it, or romanticized struggle of the mentally ill artist trying to fight through and continue to work. But it's interesting to hear that Tichy sort of, it was turned on and turned off in a way. Let me ask you about, you mentioned Art Brut, and there's an English term that gets thrown around, outsider artist. I'm sure you're familiar with that. In some ways, I think just the layperson may think of Tichy in that regard, yet you're saying that isn't necessarily the case.
Yes, of course. There is also, you might be interested in Photographie Brute, which is a collection of photographers that would suffer from mental illnesses. It was shown in New York, and it's a collection of artists with schizophrenic and other diseases who used photography. Mm-hmm. But for Miroslav Tichy, I would definitely say no, this is not an Art Brut artist. And I always try to keep Tichy out of two corners when I started promoting him. One was Art Brut, and the second was photography.
Oh, okay. Wow. When and how did he start working in photography? Clearly he was an artist. It sounds like he was born to be an artist, and he went to the academy, and he clearly has had drawing or painting as part of his mode of expression. And I do see that even in his photographic work, there's elements of drawing or handwork in his photography. But how did he end up actually using the medium of photography, and in a very unique way, which we definitely will talk about?
Well, he started photographing already in the 40s with a camera of his father, but he actually never considered being a photographer. He considered himself being a painter, and there is a large drawing corpus of works. Our foundation has about 2,000 drawings. He started photographing intensively after he dropped out from the academy, and he didn't have any more models for his drawings and paintings. So actually he started to go around town photographing women in order to later use these photographs for drawing and painting. Also, some of the models that he models, women that he would photograph, I interviewed them, and they would tell me, well, he told me he wants to take photographs because after he will paint a picture. So when he was excluded from the academy, he found his models in the streets of Kiev. And I have once calculated that during this time, he must have photographed every female being at least four times.
Wow. Yeah, because it's a small town.
It's a small town and there is a lot of photographs.
Yeah.
We have a large amount of negatives, which we have never looked at.
Wow.
And those that we have looked at, we only rarely find the positive. So we guess that there is about 40,000 negatives, and there are about 6,000 positives.
So there's a whole yet unseen substantial body of work waiting to be revealed. And maybe we could revisit this later after we talk a little bit more about his photographic approach, but I'm fascinated by the idea of clearly you're a steward for this work. I want to talk more about what will happen with those negatives and when will, I'm assuming the public will see more unseen work come out.
Yes, we would like to scan and protect and restore all the negatives. But at the moment, we are a team of three people, and we are heading to a large project in Czech Republic, also for our collection, which we call Artists for Tichy, Tichy for Artists, which is maybe the most important collection of contemporary international art in the Czech Republic. So the negatives get a little bit
put aside. Yeah. Too bad I'm not close to you. I would spend some time helping you scan. I just, the idea of making those discoveries sounds so exciting. And the fact that you have all of that, and understandably, it's a small staff, but at least it's in a safe place. You said all of that work could have easily been destroyed.
For sure it would have been, yes. And I had to fight for some years that he would not destroy too much of his work.
Of his own work.
His own work, because he would regularly use his photographs to start the fire. You know, so I decided to buy an electric oven and take this one out.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
And then, of course, he lived in a more or less unheated house. There was mice and rats, which would regularly
eat his photographs. Yeah,
which we in our database we have RC and MC, which means mice contribution and rat contribution.
Giving credit where credit is due.
And in his studio, which he kept a large part of the photographs, there was no floor. So the photographs would be sort of put on just soil, which would draw humidity.
Sure.
So actually, the older photographs, they are all gone. The photographs from the 50s, we might have some from the 60s. But when we cleared this studio, in the end, it was like an archaeological site.
You know? Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah.
We could dig out negatives from the soil.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Also in his garden, you know, there was there was a lot of the photographic equipment that he has built was just sitting somewhere in the garden. I had to take kind of a machete.
Yeah, machete. Yeah.
Cut tree. Through. And then I would find in the jungle of his garden some interesting objects that I would save.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So are we talking about literally like the cameras that he, or the lenses that he constructed? I do want to talk a little bit about that, because you said earlier he started photography. Clearly he had access to a functional manufactured camera, yet so much of the work that I'm familiar with and part of his story is the fact that he constructed his own devices, lenses, and cameras. Was that out of poverty? Was it out of, was that a just an extension of this kind of lifestyle that he was living? Was it a rejection? Was it a political statement, an artistic statement? How did he land on making these devices?
Well, I would say definitely it was motivated by him being a dissident, being somebody who would not be integrated in a society, in a small town in the 50s, doing work that was not on the list of the time, which meant social realism, continuing working in a not socialist doctrine, which meant painting women, drawing women. So there was quite a group of artists in a similar way go back to poverty and go back to not public but private, hiding his art, hiding his artistic practice. And a part of this hiding was also his clothing. He would let his clothes torn,
right,
which would protect him from being a part of society. It would protect him from also being persecuted for photographing women.
Right. So let me interrupt you there. So it sounds like some of these were intentional choices of his, or that he saw that having a torn clothing, or what I think like an American would say, looked like a homeless person, or yes, was actually protected him in a way from either being noticed or protected him from scrutiny for what he was doing creatively. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, he was several times beaten up by police for photographing, and they would destroy his cameras, his photographic equipment. They would even cut his hair, shave him in order to make him look normal, what they call normal. And after this, he realized that he has to be invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Being invisible in this kind of totalitarian society can also mean to wear a mask. And a part of the mask was also his photographic equipment, because most of the people didn't believe that it can make photos.
Mm. Yeah, so I'm going to describe an alternative situation. Clean cut, well-dressed man wandering the town with a professional looking camera with a big zoom lens and photographing women like what Tichy was doing, in many ways is, will at the very least get attention, not only draw attention to the photographer, but also probably raise issues of of whether it's appropriate those photos are even being taken of the subjects, and we can get into, you know, the public realm and privacy and things like that. But it seems like, and this is something I actually didn't consider, if I saw Tishi wandering the streets of the town in his normal appearance, and he's walking around with something that looks like it's just a tube with some wires and tape on it, one would probably think like that's not even a functioning, one wouldn't even expect maybe that that's a functioning camera. Well, there he is with his this toy that he's walking around with, and no one that did prevent that did provide him sort of that cover or freedom in a lot of ways to do what he was doing.
Yes, you say this completely correctly. Also, he had quite a clear daily program. So he would actually start early in the morning, come out of his house, do maybe some photographs there. Then he would walk 300-400 meters to the bus station, where he would take maybe a first drink and photograph there. And from the bus station, he would go to the main square, where he would just stand and photograph. And he told me, you know, I didn't exist. I was invisible as the life passed by him. And also the population knew, of course, who he was, and they would completely ignore him in his outfit.
Was he, so he was clearly small town. If he was doing this, sounds like on a routine basis, as you're describing, it would be easy to ignore him completely. The idea that one could just like, oh, there's that guy, and then move on and not even give him a second thought. Was there any sense in the town that, you know, oh, leave him alone, he's this guy, like everyone kind of, was there any sort of acceptance or protection that was afforded to him?
Well, yes. Of course, my grandmother was a large support, and she let him use a space in our house for his studio for many years until the house was taken away from my grandmother by the communist institutions, and then his studio would be cleared in a very violent way. There was a group of friends, and most of them dissidents, that would meet with him regularly. He was welcome there, but on the other hand, he was looked upon as a dissident, which meant being taken in by the police,
right?
Being taken away to the psychiatric clinic every time before 1st of May.
So, to get him off the streets for May Day.
Yes, to get him off the streets.
Let's talk a little bit about his, I want to talk about the subject matter, and you're a psychiatrist, so I think also you'll have insight to, you actually are, it's amazing that you have this, personal connection with Tishi and are the person who is very much responsible for, his work surviving, and then having not only an art background, but also a psychiatric background, because I think that's, you know, you're really the perfect person to explore the subject matter. I know, as you mentioned earlier, mainly he photographed women, and it's telling that he would photograph them mostly as inspiration for drawings or paintings. However, the body of photographic work that I think most of us are aware of, it's women in a public environment. There's definitely an erotic component to it. It raises issues of privacy versus being able to photograph in public, someone giving the permission to be photographed. And you said earlier, which I found interesting, he either explained to them or the women knew in many cases that he would be using these as inspiration for drawings or paintings. Yet, I think it gets a little complicated now when we're looking at them as straight photographs. Can we talk a little bit about maybe the resistance or acceptance, depending on how you look at it? And let me preface this by saying that I appreciate, like, I'm not passing judgment on any of it, and can appreciate not only the story and how the work's created, but also the work itself, standing independent of this mythology that's around the artist. So can we talk a little bit about the work itself?
Yes, I would reply to this first, that we are not in the 21st century, of course, with all the gender topics, but we are in the time of the 60s, 70s. I would remember Winogrand's Women Are Beautiful.
Absolutely, yeah.
It was a different time, and it was then looked at as legal and allowed to photograph women. And we have a lot of examples in photography where this led to great bodies of work.
Sure.
Then I would say that Tichý, as I experienced him, definitely was not a voyeur. I believe that actually in the time that I met him, at least, which is beginning of the 80s, and when I started to talk with him, he had no sexual interests at all. And unfortunately, I think that also, as mentioned, many psychiatric treatments that he had would take all sexuality away from him. He had electroshocks, insulin shocks. He had the whole artillery of psychiatric treatments, not by my uncle, but it was not a voyeuristic interest.
Or sexually driven pursuit of creating these photographs, or the pursuit of the women in a sexually motivated way.
I would rather say he was interested in something that he also lacked, besides sexuality, erotic feelings. He would lack intimacy.
Intimacy, right.
And that's what you see in the photographs. He's looking at women sitting together, dealing with each other, touching each other, you know, in an intimate way.
Right.
He was more interested in what do people do when they are capable of intimacy, because that's something that he couldn't.
Again, that's something maybe I didn't consider. Well, let me go back. Well, first of all, the different kinds of treatments that he was subjected to, depleting him of any sexual urgency at all. But also the fact that here's a person, a marginalized person in society, probably, and going back to what I asked earlier, whether there were people who were taking care of him or that he interacted with, the reality is that he was deprived of the kind of intimacy that you're describing. It strikes me as very sad, because he most likely couldn't just sit down on a park bench with the number of people and share the kind of intimacy that he was basically, he was basically just kind of subjected to a distant documentation of that kind of intimacy.
Yes. again, he was not a driven voyeur, you know, who would take these photos home and then live out any erotic feelings.
Right.
He was fascinated by, of course, the female figure from his student days as a painter and drawer, and even more fascinated by the movement of legs and arms. And if you look carefully, you will find that he used the negatives on which there were certain positions and movements of the body, like a knee that would be in a certain angle, or there is the lifted arm. That's a theme that he was fascinated by and that he would enlarge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was he, so he was mostly using self-constructed cameras and lenses. What was he loading? Was it 35 millimeter film that was going into these devices? What, like you say that you found negatives, what format are these negatives?
Well, in his self-made cameras, he did not have to use the holes that were in a regular negative.
Right, the sprockets, right.
So he would actually buy 6 centimeter films.
120 film, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then he would take a razor and cut it in half. It would be cheaper than buying 2 35 millimeter films.
Love it. That's actually a very good idea. I might try that.
But he was very good at mathematics, optics. So when he would construct a camera, he would exactly calculate, for example, the radius of a lens, which he would then sometimes make of a piece of plexiglass. And then I asked him, yeah, and then how did you polish it? And he said, that's the secret. You have to use toothpaste and ash.
So in some ways, well, that's, again, so here is someone that you would think, like, I think these things are what separates him from the art brute sort of approach. Clearly, he had there's the intelligence to figure out how to construct these devices. And I was just even imagining, like, all right, so he figured out to cut the film in half to get more use out of a roll, which alone, I mean, like, it's a simple kind of solution, but requires at least some way of figuring out how to make that work and not, you know, just not have a complete failure on your hands, but also figuring out, like, the mathematics of a focal plane and how long a lens barrel needs to be. Again, like, that's not just like, oh, here, I'm going to find an old tin can and then stick it on the front of a camera and that's the end of it. And then, like you described, like, he had his secret way of polishing the plexiglass, which, I mean, to me, that shows a very intentional thought process to what he was doing.
And also, he was very knowledgeable about art history. You know, he could distinguish a Canaletti painting, early and late Canaletti, Baroque painter, or he would know a lot about the world of art. He would know Picasso, Matisse, which you can see in his paintings. He would have books about art history, exhibitions that he looked through. So there again, he was definitely not an art brut artist.
there are print, like in this book that I'm holding up, a lot of these prints that are in the book, and some of them are like attached to other pieces of cardboard, or it looks like there's framing that he created himself. Are these things that he printed himself in this book?
Yes, of course. I mean, he would never give a negative to be printed. He had his dark chamber with a very spectacular enlarger, which he also made himself.
Wow.
And he would come home, usually with three films, he told me, 100 pictures. And then he was curious because he couldn't look through the finder. There was no finder.
Yeah, right.
So actually he walked through the street and positioned the camera on his breast, and he would do the fine-tuning by moving his chest up and down, left and right, and then he would press. So he had no idea what would be
in the frame on the film. Yeah.
So in the evening, he would develop the films, and then he was curious what he will find.
Right.
So he went through the negatives of the day, and if something looked like reality, the world, that's a quote,
mm-hmm.
And he printed it. But of course, he would then add, but as you know, Schopenhauer says, there is no reality. and that's how he made his prints. He always made only one or two of the same negative, because then he could sort of look what's there. And he would put the positives just to dry in books. Mm. And when they were dry, he would take them out of the books and look at them again. And then he would take a scissor and do what we do in Photoshop. He would cut off what he didn't like. Sometimes he would first make lines with pencil.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some of these photographs with these lines where he didn't continue. And then put it on a large pile of photographs, which was sometimes 1 meter high. And then when he was bored, he would go through these photographs, look at them again, and then make notes on the back of the photograph. And these notes are colors. So he would write blue, and then maybe some days later on the same positive, he would write pink. And those were the colors of passepartout, of frames, that uh-huh. he saw the photographs being put in. So sometimes I say he was not a black and white photographer, but a color photographer.
Yeah, he was at least thinking of that. And the fact that, yeah, so he's utilizing the film that he had access to. Clearly doing your own color photography is a whole other challenge. But those notes, or just a consideration of how, like if they were mounted or framed, thinking that far beyond the initial. To me, again, that shows there's a process that he's at least considering start to finish, really. The other thing that it's amazing to consider that in the 21st century, where we have access to digital photography and you see immediately what you're getting, even if you go back to analog photography, where you at least can look through a viewfinder and compose your shot. But then that magic of discovery of, like, once you develop the film, and see what you have. That curiosity that you were describing extends to the fact that he had a rough idea of position when he was lining up the shot, as you described. But to a certain degree, that's where the control ended until later when he saw what he actually got. And the idea of him cutting up is like, you know, the his manual Photoshop approach. It's just...
Yes, and this treatment of the photographic material, of course, at the same time, was interesting for artists like Arnulf Reiner and Sigmar Polke.
Right.
They would, at the same time, abuse photographic material in a similar way, which also makes him an interesting artist of his time. Not only a photographer, or I would say maybe not a photographer at all, but a painter.
Sure.
So he would say, photography is painting. Painting with light.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I totally see it. And hence my interest in his work. I think also that idea of, and you just mentioned two other artists whose work, I think, like, there is a direct connection, I think, with that, the sort of the, like what you described, like the abuse of the photographic material. And abuse sounds, that's a very aggressive word, but it actually, in Tichy's case, seems more like, he didn't hold it in a pristine, sacred manner, that the material, and clearly, to your earlier point, where there were just piles of photographs or negatives that were in the soil, that to me is like, he's going through the trouble of creating the work. He's going through all of the process. There's value to him in that work, but never too much value where it becomes, it's not like he protected these images in a way that he had some, there's a reverence for his work or his process, obviously, but like it also a casual attitude towards its, I don't know, the value of it even.
He would say, well, you see, there are flaws, there are mistakes, but the mistakes make the poetry. And to do that, you need a bad camera.
I'm going to highlight that quote for all of my friends who are so fascinated with the latest gear and lens technology, because it's, I 100% appreciate that attitude. The question I have now, it seems as though, and I feel like we could just keep talking for hours, so hopefully your time is okay.
No, I enjoy very much, okay. Of course, remembering and looking back at this fascinating friend.
Yeah, well, and what I find really, I appreciate this conversation because you're not someone, you're not a few degrees separated from him. I mean, this is someone you knew. This is someone, like, you're quoting things that he has said to you. You're not, you didn't stumble, it's not like you stumbled upon this archive of work, somebody you didn't know from decades earlier. I mean, this is so, for me, so valuable to hear firsthand about the process and the work and your relationship with him, and the fact that his body of work as it survives now is at least being cared for or protected, or also you're sharing it with the world in a manner that, at least from a an audience standpoint, I think that like I wanted to see more. What's the next thing that's going to come out? And so it's so exciting to even talk about it. The work that I recently was made aware of when I was in Paris was the television screen photographs.
Oh, you have seen that? Oh, yeah.
Just a little bit about it, because there's a book, screenshots, yes. Right?
Yeah, we did that.
Yeah, I saw a copy of it, and I leafed through it, and that work to me is very interesting. And I know there's specific some stories around that as well. Can we talk a little bit about the screenshots book, and can you tell me and the audience sort of what the focus is behind this body of work?
Screenshots is an exhibition and a book by Periferia Luzern, one of the best editors in Switzerland of art books, also photography, but not only photography. And we exhibited a body of work of Tichy's photographs that he would photograph in the evenings while watching television. So since Kyiv is very near to the Austrian border, he would have access on his television to Austrian channels during the communist time. And there would be more permissive programs, maybe revues and films where there were actresses and women that he would not be able to photograph anywhere else. If you look at some of the screenshots, you will find famous actresses. So this was kind of his break through the wall into a different world than his little world in Kyiv.
Mm-hmm.
And we are lucky to have about 400 of these, what we call screenshots. So we did an exhibition based on this material.
Let me ask you about the work then specifically. Were these negatives that you had discovered? Did you know in advance, like, did you know he was doing this, these screenshots when he was doing it, or was this discovered years later?
No, of course, these are all vintage prints made by Tichy himself.
Wow. So it's interesting from an American perspective. A lot of the things that you're bringing up are, you know, European history post-World War II. I think a lot about that from a Western perspective of things that what life was like in the Eastern Bloc, what life was like behind the Berlin Wall, what this Cold War existence, and even the way you started this conversation telling me that, you know, you moved to Switzerland as a result of the Soviet invasion in 1968. Those are things that I think, like, from an American perspective, maybe we don't have the you know, like, we learn a version of that history. You lived through it. This experience of Tichy photographing a TV broadcast from a Western country that was across the border, providing this almost like a taste of freedom that he couldn't experience in his own where he was living. It's, to me, that's a fascinating aspect of 20th century history weaving its way through your story, his story. You know, like, I think, like, we it affects people on a very personal level. It affected him on a personal level creatively, that, you know, the constraints of, like you said, he was the academy, he stopped going because they replaced all the teachers and had to do this social realism style. That's a broad political change, but it affects somebody on such a personal level. It's just fascinating to throw these examples up against what to me is like an American growing up and learning it in school. We weren't affected in that way.
Yes, exactly. And I would add to this the aspect that he was not an isolated figure, but he was part of an artist group in Moravia, in Brno, nearby, which called himself the Brno Five. And some of his practices were considered in this group as a form of resistance and survival in these very difficult circumstances. So, for example, his whole photographic process was just a part of an attitude. Once he put it in these words, I wash when it rains, because I don't pay water.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it rains, I go to the courtyard, which I have, and I wash. I make my own bread because I collect grains in the field, and then I rub them with two stones and make my own bread. I collect the potatoes that are left behind, and through this modesty, I'm independent. I'm independent of income through my sort of monastery-like life. I'm independent of sexual desires. If I need the wash machine, I will make it. And he made a wash machine from wood.
Wow. Amazing.
So it's an attitude, and this attitude includes also, I'm not selling. Yeah. I'm not showing. So, for example, when we told him, well, you will have a large retrospective in the Kunsthaus Zurich, he would say, why? If somebody wants to see my works, let him come here. I will show him.
Wow.
After I published the first papers on Tichy in the 80s, Arnulf Reiner visited Tichy in Vienna. He found him and visited him. And Arnulf Reiner is a great collector, and he wanted to buy it all.
Wow.
And he was honored, but he told him, but listen, I'm not selling anything because I don't need any money. But if you want, we can swap.
Huh.
So Arnulf did a drawing in Tichy's studio, in Tichy's house, and they swapped. After I have heard this from Reiner, I realized that that's the way how we have to deal with the photographs.
Yeah.
So we have started this project, which is called Artists for Tichy, Tichy for Artists. And our aim is to distribute a large amount of Tichy's works to artists in exchange for their works, which has actually led to a quite substantial collection of international contemporary art that is becoming the largest collection of this type in Czech Republic.
Mm, yeah.
So an artist that never was abroad, Miroslav Tichý, that didn't leave his little town for decades, brings home after a world tour of his works a unique collection of contemporary international art with works by Richard Prince, Günter Furch, Alex Katz.
Amazing.
And other great artists that would come to us to buy Tichý's.
Mm, okay.
And we said, well, consider swapping. We are not selling.
Yeah. Wow. Quite a legacy for someone who, like you said, lived in this small town, in many ways marginalized from greater society. It's really amazing. Let me ask you one, maybe this could be a question that can maybe lead us to the conclusion of the conversation. So the work, as you mentioned, for the screenshots book were original prints that Tichý had created. And I'm assuming there's amount of printed work of his still that hasn't been seen by the greater public. And then there's negatives that have been discovered that still need to be archived, scanned. So it seems like there's still an immense amount of work to be done around the archive. How much printed work is there still to be released? And then what happens with the work of the just exposed on film? Because I'm thinking the challenge would be perhaps clearly he's not making the decision of what would be printed in the future, how it will be printed or displayed. So let's talk a little bit about the existing printed work and then what happens with the film work after that.
Mm-hmm. Our main task is to build a deposit for our collections, which means Miroslav Tichý body of work, and then, of course, the contemporary international collection, which also is now quite substantial and voluminous. So we bought a building near Prague where the deposit will be.
Mm.
That's the main task I have to fulfill myself. So everything, also the negatives and all the prints, they are in a well-tempered, safe place.
Mm-hmm.
Even after I will not be here anymore. Then, of course, we would like to publish as many vintage works by Tichý as possible, maybe as an open source on internet. That's also a big project because we have about 7,000 positives. And one day we will publish them. Again, this is a next step.
Sure. And then so the structure is in place now, as you described, to protect the work that's been saved, to archive and document, and that will be a long-term future project, which, as an art lover and a photography lover, and the appreciating his work so much for myself, it's satisfying to know that just to think that all of that work, all of this amazing personal expression could have disappeared easily, just been destroyed. I'm so grateful that that it still exists and you're a big thanks to you for being part of that. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick, for your interest in Tichy, and have a nice day in New Mexico.
Thank you. Have a good evening in Switzerland. I appreciate you taking the time out. This has been a fascinating conversation. So, Roman, thank you so much, and stay well.
Thank you, Nick.
So there you go, folks. My conversation with Roman Buxbaum, all about Miroslav Tichy. As I said at the beginning, this interview went a lot longer than normal, but it was just, I was intrigued and so excited to have a conversation, not only to make discoveries for myself and share them with you, obviously, but it's a rare thing to find someone who has firsthand knowledge of some of these enigmatic, mysterious figures in the art world and certainly in the world of photography. And so I really just loved every second of talking with Roman, and I hope you enjoy it as well. I will share links to the Tichy Foundation website. I will share links to numerous examples of Miroslav Tichy's work, books that are being released of his work. And I'm really curious to hear back from you about how you react, not only to the subject matter of Tichy's work, but also his creative approach and how his life and being sort of, you know, on the margins of normal society, for lack of a better description, influenced his creativity and also just the perception of his work. It was created at a time or from a time that no longer exists. But I just find it all very fascinating, and I hope you do as well. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode or any other episode, you can go to my website, righteyedominantpodcast.com, and scroll way down to the bottom. After all of the episode listings, you'll see a place where you could send me questions or comments. Also, as I always ask, if you could rate or review this podcast or just share it with people who might think will like it, that'd be great too. I appreciate your support. That's it for today. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well. This podcast has been a production of RightEyeDominant.art. The sounds and music from this episode are courtesy of The Comet Project and Yazar.